This is MSO News Sports. I'm Bill Newell. We're joined by Robert Giron, who is the author of Big Blue Days, the story of a small-town football dynasty in Swampscott. And, Bob, first of all, welcome. Great to be talking with you.
Thank you, Bill. It's great to be here.
Well, the book is, obviously, it centers around Stan Bondelevich, the legendary coach in Swampscott. You played for Stan back in the 60s. This is a book which, if anyone looks at this book, they're going to say, oh my gosh, all the work that went into this book. This is not just some kind of, I've read a few sports pages, I got some dates, I've got some scores and a few notes and so on, recapping some wins and losses, so to speak. This is much more than that. And we'll talk about much more than that just ahead. But I guess my first question to you is, how did you get into writing this book? I can understand you're from Swampscott, nostalgia and all of that, but yet to understand or develop the scope of what all this book has in it.
Right. Well, Bill, as I got older and you mentioned nostalgia and really I thought, if you think about Bruce Springsteen's song, Glory Days, and he said, I hope when I get old, I don't sit around thinking about it. Well, guess what? I did a lot of thinking about it as I got older. And that time in Swampscott, and I'm talking about a period from maybe the most of the 50s through the 60s and into the early 70s, I just thought it was really special in a lot of ways. It was special because of the remarkable success of those football teams. I mean, when you think about 8 undefeated, untied teams in 17 seasons, 10 conference titles, 7 state titles, and they won the first Division II Eastern Massachusetts Super Bowl game in 1972. So it was that, the remarkable success in this little, fairly small town on the North Shore. And then the coach, and you mentioned him, Stan Bondelevich, was just a legendary, colorful coach. Then all of the players. So I decided I was going to retire from law practice. I wanted to do something different. And I thought this would be interesting and enjoyable for me to do and something worthwhile to try to preserve. So I then set out to decide how to go about doing it.
Yeah. Now, you went to the Lynn Library, you looked through microfilm of the newspapers, and when I was in college, it was probably the last time, or no, actually maybe some in graduate school, mostly college, going through microfilms in the library and getting those big headaches. I don't know if they still do that to you, but those machines or whatever they used to have there. But it's much more than that, too, the research that went into this. But I guess tell us the scope of the research, because this is a multi-year project, too.
Yes, it was a little over 3 years, not full-time, but a lot of time, on and off, and literally days and days spent in the Lynn Public Library, which I won't lie to you, that was not the most enjoyable part of the of the process, but it was necessary. And thankfully, the Lynn item covered high school sports, and they still do, but covered it so thoroughly that I had all the details in there. But the more interesting and fun part of the research was interviewing former players and coaches. And I interviewed over 50 people during this. Some of them in multiple sessions, for example, Coach Lynch, who recently passed away, Richard Lynch, because he was a key part of it through the whole period. And that was a huge part of this because the human interest side, the anecdotal stories that you'd hear, and from the players, the former players, the impact that participating in playing had on them and affected them was a huge part of what I wanted to write about. So it was a combination of those things and also other newspapers, the Salem News, the Boston papers, the Swampscott Reporter in the later years when it was available. So there was a lot that went into that. And then the writing part, of course, is writing and rewriting and trying to get it right and figuring out how to structure the book.
Yeah. And we can talk about the chapters and how they're kind of laid out and all that in a moment or two, and follow up on you mentioned Dick Lynch, and maybe there's a couple of great stories, Dick Lynch stories in the book as well, as many of them, I'm sure. But let's begin with Stan Bondelevich. So Tell us about his arrival. He was from Hudson, New Hampshire, right?
Yes,
Hudson, New Hampshire,
yes,
and he comes to Swampscott. So it's not like he's not a Giron. He's not a lifelong Swampscott resident. Whatever, he moves into Swampscott, and then what happens?
Well, let me first of all, Hudson. He his final season in Hudson, Stan Bondalevich, his team finished 10-0, undefeated. They beat a team that had won 59 straight games, Concord. They had the most successful season in the history of the high school. In the meantime, Swampscott High School had lost 21 of 22 games. They went out looking for a new coach. They found Stan. They brought Stan into town. And his first season in this program and with this team that had won one game in 22, he came within a touchdown of winning the conference title. His team finished 5-3. They upset Amesbury, and Amesbury had won 31 straight games. That's what he did in the first year. How did he do it? Well, he did so many things immediately upon arriving to town, and he basically... His first quarterback back in 1953 was a fellow named Peter Cassidy, who ended up being the police chief in Swampscott. And Peter Cassidy, decades afterwards, he described it and he said, when Stan Bondalevich came, he arrived, he turned around the team and he turned around the town. And he just was, I could talk all day about what he did and how he did it. But just to give you a couple of examples, because he was such a innovator and he understood psychology. He arrived in town and he saw that the team was named the Sculpins. That was the nickname of the team. And he looked it up and he found, as he said, that a Sculpin was also sometimes referred to as a mudhake. And it was an ugly, bottom-feeding, useless, bony fish. And his quote was, "I'm appalled. If our opponents had known the true meaning of the word, they would have laughed us off the field. How can you inspire fear when you tell them the mudhakes are coming?" So he changed the nickname of the team to the Big Blue. And there were people who kind of reacted not all that well to it, thinking, well, that's kind of over the top and ostentatious for this little town, little high school, call itself the Big Blue. But that was precisely the way Stan was. He was over the top, and he saw the psychological value in it. He'd take these little guys, 100 pounds, and put shoulder pads on them and tell them, you're part of the Big Blue. You're part of something big, and you're going to play big. And it worked. Yeah. The other thing he did very early on is he sensed that there were segments in the community, parents, who didn't want their kids playing football for a variety of reasons. One, obviously, concern about their getting hurt, their boys getting hurt. Two, there's a part of Swampscott very concerned about education in the sense of getting their kids into the best schools, and they really emphasized studying, didn't want anything detracting from that. Okay, and Stan somehow knew he had to deal with that and address it, because in a town like Swampscott, for him to get where he wanted to get, he needed to have total buy-in. He needed to have total involvement. He couldn't have big segments of the population not participating. Well, in his second season, what he did is he announced they were having a parents' clinic, and he brought as many parents into this clinic as he could. And really, it was a combination of sort of a primer on high school football 101 and what I describe as a kind of propaganda dog and pony show, where he brought in the team doctor and the trainer and explained everything they did to try to make the sport safe for the kids, make it fun for the kids. He had them run through drills. And again, it just worked, and he increased participation immensely in those first few years. It was just he another great quote by Stan in the newspaper about that clinic. He said, "We hope to convince the parents that properly supervised, high school football is not really much more dangerous than a fast set of tennis. And, you know, reading that, if you played football, you'd say, I wonder what kind of tennis he had in mind. But that's the kind of thing he could do. And, of course, the coaching and the fundamentals was huge. But he brought around this new spirit, and it happened very quickly. And then he worked to build on that.
And I know one of his disciples, Fran York, who was on his coaching staff, I would call him a disciple. In other words, he spread the word about Stan and what he did. Just as you were just describing there, I could hear Fran telling very similar types of stories about the way that he inspired and his players and the community as well, and how that impacted Fran as well, is to see this whole community come together. And that again is a whole nother part. When you were growing up, Bob, is that Saturday afternoon football was the only thing going on in Swampscott.
Yeah, that was it. Saturday afternoon, it was, well, you know, I don't often use the comparison, but it was like Friday Night Lights that they talked about down in Texas. In this small town, football was the thing. I was going to say the other thing that Stan did, and the parents who were concerned about their kids not having enough time to study and have the top grades to get into top schools, he would talk all the time about how many players that he coached ended up going to the top schools, and he'd make the point that, you know, you can be a top student, but there are lots of other top students you're competing against to get into these schools. And if you have something else like football, it's often the thing that gets you in. It's the tiebreaker. And he'd talk about that as well as, of course, just the character building aspects of the program. And he always, one thing about Stan Bonilevich, he always emphasized the importance of the academic side of school. And he'd talk about that. And I'll just tell you, one thing that I think kind of tells you where he was coming from. When my family moved into Swampscott in 1965, within a few days of our being in town, he came to visit and introduce himself to my brothers and me. And of course, he knew our dad, who was a football coach. So Stan came in and he met with us. And when he left some gifts. And what he left were not footballs. He left a typewriter and a book of Grantland Rice sports stories. And I think that, you think about that, that tells you something about where he was coming from and the message he was trying to send to both the kids and the parents about school and education.
So he didn't help the Gerons buy a house in Swampscott?
No.
I mean, that wasn't part of the deal?
No. He didn't do that. Didn't buy a house. But, you know,
I didn't mean buy a house, but I mean at least, you know, usher, help your real estate agent, you know, kind of talk up the community a little bit.
Yeah. No, not that I know of. And actually, my parents rented in Swampscott. we rented. But, he certainly was a coach who would go out of his way constantly to try to encourage kids to play football. I mean, that was, he came into Swampscott and he built that program up so that I think his first year they had 30-something players playing, and by maybe 5 or 6 years later they were dressing like 100 kids between the varsity and the JVs. And he did that by constantly basically promoting. Stan Bonilevich was many things as a coach. Probably the thing he wasn't best at was X's and O's. I mean, his assistants did a lot of that stuff. He was more of a big picture coach, but he was Lynn Item wrote a review about my book, and they said I kind of portrayed him as sort of part tent preacher and part Pied Piper. And he was certainly, there was that aspect to him. Promoter, but he was a great organizer, and he was a counselor. If you had a problem, whether you were a player or not, you could go to him, and he'd talk to you, and he'd listen to you. And he was an entertainer. Like I've said, that sometimes it seemed like a three-ring circus, and he was both the ringmaster and one of the main attractions. But above everything else, he was a motivator. That was, I mean, he was just an amazing motivator. Yeah. Whether it was a locker room speech or whether it was talking to the students as a whole, talking to the parents, he had a way to inspire you and to bring you in and make you part of what he was trying to accomplish.
Yeah. I'm going to jump away from Stan for a moment here. Sure. And ask you to talk about your brother, Dick Geron, because I suppose that if there was one athlete in this time period, outstanding athlete in Swampscott, it would have been your brother, Dick Geron, and what he was able to accomplish while in Swampscott and, of course, after Swampscott as well. But, I mean, tell us more about your brother. And I'm sure you've been asked this question before, but take it away. What would you say?
Let me start by saying this. I was so lucky to have one season where I was able to play with him as a teammate. We played together at Swampscott. I was a senior, and he was a sophomore. And so we played football and basketball together. And there's no doubt I'm biased. It's my brother. The best teammate I ever had at any level, on any team. And I'll bet if you went out and you talked to the guys who played with him at any level on any team, you would hear the same thing. In terms of his ability, he had just great natural athletic talent. But what he did, he was not one of these kids who'd show up and just get by with his talent. He maximized it. He was the most disciplined kid. He worked very hard at it. But he was also the most unselfish athlete you're ever going to see. It was always about his teammates, and there was nothing insincere about it. That's just the way he was. What he accomplished, and a lot of people would know this, but he was a first-team high school and first-team college All-American. He was named by the Boston Globe as one of the 10 top Massachusetts schoolboy football players of the 20th century. He was captain of the Yale baseball team and was drafted by the St. Louis Cardinals baseball organization. Of course, he played football. He was an Pro Bowl returner and safety. Of course, he went on to coach after his playing career. He was an NFL Coach of the Year in 2001. He scored the winning basket to win the state title for Swampscott in his junior year in a Tech tourney basketball. He just could do just about, and he did just about anything. But I know it's a cliche, I guess, that I think is sometimes overused. In his case, absolutely true. As great an athlete as he was, he's a better person. He's one of the finest people you'll ever meet.
You know, the book, and whether how much time we'll be able to get to all this, but you weave in names from around the area, Aganis, Conigliaro, all these names. But I want to circle back, and, you know, when you talk about Stan, I think that another name with that coaching staff, and Dick Lynch, you just mentioned a moment ago, passed away several weeks ago, who was the coach, his probably top assistant, right, in football for many years, absolutely. Later, the basketball coach in Swampscott, athletic director in Swampscott, and I, you know, the father of Channel 5's Mike Lynch, who was a quarterback at Swampscott High School and went on to play at Harvard. But Dick Lynch, I got one story. I definitely want to ask you about Dick Lynch that's in the book here. But other than that, you know, tell me about Dick Lynch, because Dick had, you know, Dick was the X and O's guys, I believe. Dick was the maybe the more hard nosed coach, if you will, in your face. But yet, on the other hand, there's a story or two in the book about players coming back to see Dick Lynch. I think Mike Powers was one of the names.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yes. Who came back and kind of put tears in Coach Lynch's eyes. But those are the stories that, you know, came out a few weeks ago when Dick Lynch passed away that we don't always know about. But that's why he was a coach, because of the other things that he did off other than X's and O's and, you know, and calling plays during a game or whatever.
Yeah. Well, you were right. I mean, Dick Lynch was the key assistant, and he and Stan Bonilevich, Stan came in 1953. He hired Dick Lynch the following year. He met Dick Lynch and recognized, I think, immediately that this was a guy he had to have on his staff. And Dick Lynch was there with him until the Super Bowl year. He coached the Super Bowl team, and then he left to become the Danvers athletic director. So he was there through, except for the first and last year, the whole period I've written about. And he was an exceptional coach. I played basketball for him, and obviously he was an assistant and the key guy on the football squad. He was a man who, he was tough. He was hard-nosed. He was always straight with the kids, so you always knew where you stood with him. He was very direct, excellent with fundamentals. He would, and I've used the phrase, they were a great team because Dick Lynch would coach you up. And Stan would build you up. And by that, I mean Stan would really make you believe you could do things. And Dick Lynch would coach you and to the point where you could do those things. So they were a great team. Great man. One of the things I was really blessed in writing this book is I was able to spend hours and hours with Mr. Lynch. And fortunately, if I decided a few years later, that wouldn't have happened. And this book would not be anything is, you know, the same as it is without him, because there's so much in this that came from him. He was so gracious and so generous with his time, and he was just a legendary man, you know. And I know I've never heard of any player who didn't respect Coach Lynch.
You know, when I was in education, I worked with a series of at-risk kids. So I always was, you know, you're always looking to, you know, find out ways to connect and help out in difficult situations. So you have a story in the book about Dick Lynch when he was coaching freshman basketball. It must have been at Swampscott. Maybe you can share this story because it's a classic. Because, but I'm just going to give you a little. I'm going to give the listeners a little bit of a highlight here where. A mom comes and they're having trouble with the son and please help us. We're having a hard time controlling him. And doesn't that sound like today? I mean, seriously, that could be a problem today. It could have been a problem 20 years ago or whenever. But this was what, probably 1950s, right? Late 50s, I think, or 57.
Late 50s,
yeah.
Right.
So in anyways, so now they have these guys on the team. They play a basketball game in Lynn. And you know the story, I guess, I'm getting at here. The Swampscott players are being taunted a little bit, and he walks out. But maybe you go back and fill in the holes here. But tell us about that story with Coach Lynch getting back on the bus after that freshman basketball game.
Yeah. Well, the two players that were a big part of that story were Mike Powers, who you mentioned, and Jim Lyons, who went on to captain Northeastern football and to do some coaching himself. The chapter that I write that story about, the chapter was titled Tough as Nails, and it's really about these two kids. They were kind of problem kids. They were difficult. They were pugnacious, got into a lot of trouble. And Stan Bondelevich told Dick Lynch that Dick Lynch was coaching freshman basketball, and he told him about these two kids, and he said, I want you to look out for these kids. They have a tendency to get into some trouble, but they're good kids, and they're, you know, good football players, and we want to make sure they get on the right path. And then, as you mentioned, the mother of Jimmy Lyons showed up at school and told Mr. Lynch she was at her wit's end. She really needed his help, and he had her permission to do whatever it took to keep her boy in line. Well, telling Dick Lynch that would be something, because he would do whatever it takes. So he had them both on the basketball team, even though he said neither one of them could hit the backboard with the basketball. But he thought, you know, we'll keep them occupied and involved with the team, and that will get them, you know, doing things the right way and keep them out of trouble. But unfortunately, they had this incident where they played a game against St. Mary's freshmen, and there were these older kids heckling Powers and Lyons from the stands. After the game, Mr. Lynch got into a discussion with the officials, so he sent his players out to the bus, and sometime later, when he left and went out to the bus, he said he came upon something that looked like a war zone. He saw these four kids who had been heckling the players spread out all over the field or the parking lot. One looked like he was unconscious, and the others were not in very good shape. And he climbed onto the bus, and there were Powers and Lyons sitting together. And as only Dick Lynch could describe it, he said it was as quiet as church on that bus. And Powers' glasses were broken, which happened all the time because he was always getting into these melees. And Lyons had a little bruise on his face, and it turned out these guys had started. They'd actually been harassing or picking on one of their teammates, and Powers and Lyons stepped in, and it ended very quickly, according to the bus driver, who said he'd never seen anything like it in his life. But these two kids were just tough as nails, and there's more in the book about other problems and things, trouble they got into. But the thing was, the coaches recognized that they were really good kids who needed a lot of guidance, a lot of help. And those kids needed Swampscott football, because Swampscott football gave them things like being part of a team, and it was sort of a family thing and a sense of direction and purpose. And it really is, when you said at-risk kids, I think one of the things I hope people would see in this book is how high school sports can be something that really helps and saves kids who are at risk of going the wrong way in life. Now, years later, I'm saying decades later, Richard Lynch is at an event, and this man comes up to him that he doesn't even recognize, and he says, "Mr. Lynch, I don't know if you remember me. I'm Mike Powers." And he said he talked to Mr. Lynch about his family and about his career and how he felt blessed in many things, and he said, "I came here to talk to you and to thank you, because I owe this all to you, Mr. Lynch. Thanks for everything you did." And Mr. Lynch, who was not prone to do this, he was a tough guy, he told me, he said, "You know, I almost started crying." But that's, you know, what coaches can do for kids.
And it's funny, because as I was reading that in the book, I think you say in the book that Mike Powers comes up to him and said, I want to talk to you alone for a minute. You know what I mean? So I'm thinking, oh, my gosh, what's he – you know, Dick Lynch is probably thinking, oh, my gosh, what did I do to this kid? Oh, my gosh. So anyways, but it's obviously it didn't turn out. Hey, I got to ask you one other story, because I was fascinated, too, the way you were able to weave a couple of things in there. So now we have – I guess it was back in this with Title IX, right, with the women, girls' sports.
Yes.
But yet before Title IX, Dick Lynch, here's my last question on a Dick Lynch story, but I love this story, too, and this fact where he is he's the boys' basketball coach. Flora McLaren?
McLaren
is the girls', well, involved, is she the girls' basketball coach?
She
She's the girls' basketball coach in Swampscott. But they both want court time. Now, nowadays, it's almost like we understand that the boys 1 week may practice at 2:30 or 3 when school gets out, and the girls practice at 4:30 or whatever the schedule might be, that or they practice at different sites now in town or whatever. That's how they because everything is equal now. Right. We just take that for granted. But share that story, because Dick, you know, but I won't go too far with it, but I want you to share this story. So here's Dick Lynch. Again, we're talking 50s probably, right? Maybe early 60s with this story, I'm thinking. Yeah, but maybe pick that up where Dick Lynch is having a little dispute with his fellow worker there at Swampscott High.
Thanks. Well, Dick Lynch had actually been coaching basketball at St. John's Prep, because Harold Martin was still the basketball coach in Swampscott. And in 1963... Dick Lynch became the varsity coach in Swampscott. Stan Bondalevich was the athletic director. Girls' coach since the 40s was Flora McLaren, who was one really tough, tough woman, a great coach. Her teams never lost. She had better records than Stan Bondalevich. I mean, it was incredible. Well, Swampscott, back then, of course, we went to the old high school, which is the Greenwood Avenue. It's a small building, and we had a very small gym. And they had this sliding wall that divided the gym in half. So if you had phys ed class, the girls were on one side of the wall and the boys on the other. And when Lynch started, went to have his practice, he found out that he only had one half of this small court to practice on. Well, he liked full court presses, man-to-man defense, fast-breaking teams, and he couldn't practice those things on half of a small court. So he went to Mrs. McLern and said, listen, can we work something out? And her position was, no, this was always fine before, and I'm not going to change. He went to Stan, and Stan said, okay, we'll change, and we'll change the schedule so you'll have this period of time, and then later Flora will have another time. They called Flora in, and Stan told her, and she started to, her eyes filled up with tears. And at that point, Stan Bondalevich said, forget about it. We're going to leave things the way they are. Well, Dick Lynch, you know, wasn't going to leave things the way they were. He was going to coach the way he needed to coach. And he went to Stan and said, listen, I can't work this out with Flora. So unless you change, you're going to have to get a new coach. So he had basically, you know, forced Stan's hand. They worked out a schedule. They called Mrs. McLern back in. They told her, Stan said, this is how it's going to be. Mr. Lynch is going to have the gym during this period, and then you'll have it later. And Flora didn't cry anymore. As Dick Lynch told the story, she turned and looked at him, pointed her finger and said, you dirty bastard, and stormed out of the office. But, you know, they were both, Dick Lynch and Flora McLern were both just incredible coaches, and they were both tough and they were both competitive, and they worked together and accomplished great things. And as I said in the book, though, with Stan Bondalevich as the athletic director, there was a certain fall boys sport that was always going to get more attention and precedence. Stan was, I think he was a good athletic director, but he was a football coach above everything else.
Well, you know, there's just so many different ways I could go with this. I'm wondering here, you know, I look at, I mentioned some of the names earlier that are in the book that I got a chance to meet. I'm going to throw out a few names and let you pick up where you want to with this, okay? Sure. So let me just try a few here. So we've done the big ones here with Dick Lynch and Stan, obviously. Elmo Benedetto, Rhett, who was the former athletic director in Lynn years ago, had the whole city. Red Hoffman, the item sports editor, who I'm sure you must have known over the years. Barry Gallup, who later went on and was at Boston College in their athletic department. And then we talked about your brother Dick, but you got Bill Adams, Fran York, and all there. But what might you pick up with some of these names that I kind of mentioned?
Well, just the thing that comes to mind with Elmo Benedetto is he's actually the guy that helped bring Stan to Swampscott. He and Stan were at BU taking graduate courses, and that's how they met. And Elmo was in Lynn. And Stan, in the story that I came across, Stan was at Hudson, but he was looking for new challenges, and he saw this ad in the paper about looking for a new athletic director and football coach in Swampscott. And he turned to Elmo Benedetto and said, Benny, where the hell is Swampscott? And Benedetto told him about Swampscott, and the rest is history. But he and Elmo, I know, were good friends. And Elmo Benedetto was the athletic director in Lynn for years and really oversaw the Joyce Jamboree and I think also the Agganis Classic, which were back then were just huge events that attracted all kinds of attention. Red Hoffman, of course, for a long time was sort of the primary sports reporter, and I think he became the editor following Ed Cahill for a while at the Lynn Item. And Red Hoffman, I relied heavily on a lot of the articles that he wrote because he followed high school football and Swampscott football very closely back then and really covered it very well. And so what he wrote was a wealth of information. You mentioned Barry Gallup. He just has over the years been such a factor when he was such a mentor. Barry was, I think, 3 years ahead of me in high school. And I remember when I moved into town and my family, he came and introduced himself, which is kind of unusual for somebody who's a freshman in college to come to a high school junior, introduce himself. Took us around town. I remember he had this yellow Jeep, and he introduced us to all a lot of the athletes, and took us down to Phillips Park and involved us in basketball games down there. And he was just that kind of guy. He was a tremendous player when he played at Swampscott, and his team as a senior, they won the state championship. They were undefeated. Barry went on to BC and set receiving records, but he's always been so supportive of Swampscott and Swampscott sports. Couldn't say enough about him. They had so many outstanding football players and athletes. If you think of Billy Conigliaro, Tony's brother, who was an outstanding high school football player, but he was a baseball player. He was so talented. He was the number one draft pick by the Red Sox as a baseball player. On the same team was Mike Mussovas. He was a number one draft pick by the St. Louis Cardinals baseball team. So they had all these, they had quite a few outstanding athletes in the 50s, George Blaze and Bill Carlin and Bobby Carlin. But the thing is, and the reason I think they were so successful is they had a lot of kids who weren't outstanding athletes. They were maybe average or even a little less than average, but between Stan Bonilevich building them up and Dick Lynch and the other assistants coaching them up, they made them good players, and they became good players, and they were essential to the success of Swampscott sports. But the more important thing ultimately is going through that process helped them in their later lives, because the quote I saw more than any other, or I heard more than any other in interviewing people and reading about Stan, is people would say, his magic, what he did best was he made you believe in yourself. And that's what he did. Fran York, as you know, when he left Swampscott, he had his own Hall of Fame coaching career, Manchester, Mass. Yeah. And he's the first to say he took so many things that he learned being in the system with Stan and applied them himself. And I think Ronnie Cochran did the same thing when Ronnie Cochran went to Triton. They just would learn all of these things about how to motivate, how to organize, how to inspire. The other things we haven't talked about is Stan actually could make it fun. And honestly, there aren't many kids, I think, if you ask them, was high school football practice a lot of fun? I don't think you'd hear a lot of kids say, oh yeah, it was really a blast. But with Stan, he had a way to make it fun. He was a performer, and he'd do these things, whether it was throwing a fake temper tantrum and throwing himself on the ground. I recall one episode related to me by a player. He said they were preparing for the Winthrop game, and the planes to Logan were flying over the field, and one came particularly low, and Stan threw himself to the ground and said, hit the deck, it's a Winthrop spy plane. And then he said, we got to run some fake plays now, and he had them run fake plays to fool the Winthrop spy plane. But he'd do things like that regularly to kind of lighten the mood a bit and reduce stress and tension. He was very good at that.
Actually, I'm glad you shared that Fran York story, because when I was at WESX years ago, I remember when Fran went to Manchester, and it was almost like a cookie cutter, kind of a smaller version of Swampscott that he was able to kind of recreate in Manchester before it was Manchester by the Sea as we know it by today in Manchester, Massachusetts, as you're referring to. But they were – football was number one there too for so long in Manchester on Saturday afternoons. It was huge. And Fran was a big part of it, as you mentioned. I want to get to kind of the end here, but what about the end for Stan? When of course he came back years later, but you kind of focus on the 50s, 60s, and 70s. Tell us about the end of Stan's coaching. The first time around in Swampscott.
Well, in 1972, they won the Super Bowl. And Stan often said that was his best of all of his championship teams. That was his best team. It was a senior-dominated team. In fact, I think my brother Michael was the quarterback. He was a junior. And Ray McCollum was an end who was a junior on that team. And all the other starters were seniors. So the next year, it looked like it was not going to be a strong year for Swampscott. But actually, they ended up going undefeated until their final game against Marblehead. They had a tie in there but the final game against Marblehead, and they lost that game. But Stan, at that point, started talking about maybe he'd coach another 2 years or so. you know, in Swampscott. But he was also, he also was saying that they couldn't continue this level of success because of the growth of the conference, bigger schools coming in, and also that the people in the town really had almost, he felt, had almost gotten so used to winning that they really didn't appreciate what the team and, frankly, what he was accomplishing. I mean, Stan did have an ego. There's no question about that. And so the next couple of years, I think he went 5-5 the next year after that 7-1-1 team, my brother Michael's senior year. And then the next year they were, I think they were 7-3, but Stan's wife, Dot, passed away that year. And he announced shortly after she passed away that that was his last year coaching in Swampscott, and he was the athletic director, so it was a full-time job. And he said he really needed to spend more time with his kids. His son, David, I think, was something like 10 years old at the time. Mm-hmm. And so he did resign that. I think 1975 was his last year in Swampscott. Then, and he stepped down as athletic director. But there were some other issues. He was having trouble with the some people on the school committee. They were requiring that he reapply for the job, like all coaches, reapply for the job every year, and he didn't appreciate that after all the things he felt he'd accomplished. So there were a number of other things going on. And he stepped down, and then shortly after that, he took a job coaching at Bishop Fenwick. But he was no longer athletic director, so it was a less, you know, demanding kind of job in terms of his time, and he was able to spend more time with his son David and his girls. Yeah. So, the thing is, he came back, of course, 5 years later.
I think that's actually when I met him at that point, and I remember doing a story with him. It was around Thanksgiving, and went over to his house, and we did this long interview. And but a lot of the interview was on cooking Thanksgiving dinner. That's what the interview ended up being, you know. And that's what here's this guy that, you know, think of all the stories you just shared with us. That's just a tip of the iceberg of what he did in football. And yet, you know, on Thanksgiving Day, this guy was cooking Thanksgiving dinner too. I mean, what I understand, yeah.
Well, I think he liked to cook and he loved to garden. He was a gardener. But when you learn about Stan's childhood growing up, you understand it better because he grew up on a farm. His father was a farmer, and Stan grew up in Acton on a farm. And interesting, his parents were Eastern Europe immigrants. And neither one of them could ever really read or speak English very well. And Stan went to high school, played football, and played well enough to earn a scholarship offer, football scholarship, to St. Anselm College in Manchester. But his father did not want him to go to college. His father wanted him to stay and eventually take over the farm. And so there was a little bit of a falling out, but Stan, I think, even then recognized that college was going to be important to him, given, you know, his own ambitions and what he hoped to accomplish in his life. And I learned that when he was at St. Anselm, his parents finally came to a football game. And when his father heard the crowd cheering and yelling after Stan made a play, he changed his whole view and thought, well, you know, college and football probably is a good idea for Stan, you know. But Stan was always, as I said at the outset, always really very focused on academics and other things. He was in college, he participated in dramatics. He was in the chorus, the college chorus. And his son David never really played high school. He didn't play high school football. He was small. What he did was he played in the band. And he became a very gifted musician, and he went on to attend the Berklee School of Music and MIT at the same time. Today, he's a professor at University of Colorado, Denver, And he's also won a couple of Emmys for work in music and music scores.
Oh, wow.
So, and I think there was some a talent there. Both Stan and his wife, Dot, had talent in music as well as coaching.
And if I could carry this metaphor a little further, make it into a metaphor, he was kind of the orchestra leader, as you he may not have been the best musician, but he was the orchestra leader for sure in this whole Swampscott adventure. Well, we've been talking with Bob Giron in his book Big Blue Days. We'll put a link up on our website on some other links of use possibly for purchasing the book or whatever. But anything else you want to share with us about the book? And we've talked, the research of it and all the work you did to get this book done.
I guess what I'd say to sum up on the book is that when I was writing the book, I got some help from a fellow who up in New Hampshire who'd helped other people with books. He had written a book himself. He's a friend of mine. And he just made suggestions. He read chapter after chapter, and it was very helpful. But one of the things he said at the outset, he had asked me why I was writing it and what it was about. And I told him the things that we'd talked about, the great success of the teams, the memorable coach, and so forth. And he said, writing's kind of a funny thing. Often when you set out to write a book and you think you know what it's going to be about, you think you know why you're writing it. And often you discover in the process it's a little different. And that happened. I didn't think it would happen, but it did happen to me. After talking to all these guys, and some of them playing back in the early 50s, and what football meant to them, and how it affected their lives, ultimately, I concluded that the most special thing about Big Blue Days isn't all the winning, it's all the learning. And when you think about it, it's high school football. And the only reason it exists is for education. Doesn't exist to make money. Doesn't even exist to entertain. Although with those guys coaching us and, we and our fans were often entertained. It exists to educate. And we talked about Jimmy Lyons and Mike Powers. And there are hundreds and hundreds of kids out there that, like them, really needed that sport. I think any kid can benefit from sports. But for many, their most enduring, valuable learning experiences come from participating in high school sports. And their most memorable teachers are their coaches. And I would hope anyone reading this book would come away and recognize that truth and therefore recognize how important sports is to education.
And I remember a quote. It was a Steve Krause comment. I think he wrote about Dick Lynch a few weeks ago after his passing. I think it was a quote similar to for someone who expects more of you, it impacts you in a very different way because they're expecting more from you. And that probably tells the story of this whole experience here. Hey, I want to mention, I just forgot to talk to you about the photos in the book, because maybe you could share a note or two on those, because it's funny. I look quickly. There are some great photos in the book, the old black and whites that probably were taken from contributed by different, donated by people and from the newspapers. Yes. And so on. It's funny. I'll just share one thing. So I noticed, I looked at Mike Lynch on the team photo. There he's got number 5 on, and of course he now works at Channel 5, in sports. But any notes on these photos that you got? Because that in itself, a book like this, you got to have some photos, but you have some great photos in the book.
Well, the photos, as you say, came from different sources, and I decided to put 3 4 on the cover. So on the cover of the book, there's a photo of Stan Bonilevich and Bill Adams. And Bill Adams, we didn't talk about Bill here, but Bill Adams, first of all, probably from anything I've heard or read, the most dominating lineman to ever play at Swampscott. I haven't heard about anybody who was more dominating. And he was a teammate of mine. He was a year behind me. Just an outstanding leader and player. Went on to play in the NFL. And so that's a photo. you know, some of these I look at, I'm not sure where I got them. A lot of them came from a fellow named Louis Gallo, who's sort of the unofficial town historian who just has all these photos. A lot of them came from yearbooks from newspapers. And then also on the cover, I have a picture of my brother, Dick, as a sophomore, and that's from our game against Marblehead, which I don't like to talk about too much because we lost it 22-21. But Dick wore number 5 as a sophomore and junior and then switched to number 40 as a senior. The other picture is one of the most famous remembered plays of all, which is Mike Lynch kicking a field goal to beat Marblehead and extend a win streak that went 3 years as of that time. And then on the back is a picture of the great George Blaze. And George Blaze was just an outstanding halfback and star of back-to-back undefeated teams for Swampscott in the 50s, 57, 58. You can just, I think when you look at that photograph, you can see there's somebody who's approaching, intending to try to tackle George, and it seems absolutely certain that he's not going to have any chance at all, given the move that George seems to be making. But the photographs, you know, you had to go through and choose and pick, and I just tried to pick photographs that I thought showed the program at different stages. A number of them are of the coaching staffs too.
Yeah, those are interesting photos. And my Bill Adams, I got to know him later on too. I mean, great guy, coach. Actually, coached my daughter in basketball, of all things. Yeah, so go figure that. But like you said, a wonderful guy. And, the, you know, it's another thing, too, when you showed the photo of Mike Lynch kicking the field goal in high school. Now, he did the same thing in the Harvard-Yale game later on, which speaks to another thing that you kind of mentioned earlier. All these players that went on and had careers beyond Swampscott in athletics. Doesn't always happen, but in this era, a lot of players went on and did things beyond, whether it be at college or onto the pros, as with your brother and others, Bill Adams, you mentioned. But there is just so much of that coming out of this era as well.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because I'd say two things. And one was the 1967 Swampscott High School football team. I mean, Swampscott's a town with 13,000 residents or so. A high school, I don't know what you had, about 200 kids in a class, something like that. The 1967 Swampscott team had 3 players on that team who all went on eventually and played in the NFL multiple seasons and played regularly. Bill Adams played for the Buffalo Bills during the O.J. Simpson era. And Tom Toner was a starting linebacker for the Green Bay Packers. And then my brother Dick, as we talked about before, all 3 of those guys from one team. I think that's really special. If you looked around New England, I don't know that you'd find another city, let alone a town, that had 3 guys on the same team that went on to the NFL. The other thing I'd mention, when you talked about Harvard and Mike Lynch going on to kick at Harvard, and Stan about education and how the kids playing football in Swampscott moved on to good schools. The 1968 team, I was looking at that team and where the players went from that team, the starters on that team. Just to give you an idea, the left halfback went to Yale, the right halfback went to Princeton, the quarterback went to Brown, the center went to Harvard, the left guard went to Colby, the left tackle went to Harvard, the right guard went to Amherst, one of the ends went to Bowdoin. I mean, that's one team, and those are the kind of schools these guys ended up in. So, I mean, that's, again, I think highly unusual, a public high school, of that size, and the football players. And now, you know, a good part of that was the culture that got fostered through that program. You were expected to be a leader, not just on the field, but in the school and generally.
Well, Bob, great talking with you. Great book, and thanks so much for your time. And hopefully we'll talk again at some point.
Thank you, Bill. It's been a pleasure. Yeah.
Bob Geron, who is, the author of Big Blue Days, the story of a small-town football dynasty in Swampscott. I'm Bill Newell here on MSO News Sports.